All right, welcome to another deep dive. You know why you're here. You want to learn, get smarter, figure out how the world works. But you don't have all day, right?
Nope, not at all.
And that's where we come in. We take these really complicated, fascinating topics, dig into the sources, and pull out the gold. Just for you.
The stuff that matters. The stuff that makes you go, huh, I never thought about it that way.
Exactly. And today, we're going deep into the world of fluid dynamics.
Turbulent world, you might say.
Yeah, very good. We got a real gem here, this monograph put together from a bunch of research papers and lectures, even going back to a 1951 report called On Turbulent Fluid Motion.
Serious stuff. This isn't just some light browsing material.
Definitely not. But it gets right to the heart of how fluids move, the kind of problems that are nonlinear, tough to solve. And that's what we're here for, to figure out what the big questions are, what techniques they used, how they tackle these challenges, especially when things get extreme, you know?
When the flow gets really wild.
Right, right. So where do we even begin? This Hofkohl transformation, that's one thing that really caught my eye. Sounds kind of like magic, honestly. What's the deal with that?
It's kind of like a magic trick, yeah. This Hofkohl transformation, it's a way to deal with these nonlinear diffusion equations. They're a nightmare, you know? Imagine trying to solve a Rubik's Cube that keeps changing its colors and sides while you're working on it.
Oh, man, I can't even imagine.
That's what a nonlinear equation is like. But this transformation, it's like finding a hidden pattern, a secret formula. You look at equations 1.2 and 1.3, and you see how they basically untangle the mess, make it linear.
So it's like a cheat code for a super hard level in a video game.
Yeah, exactly. You simplify it, make it manageable. And the best part, it lets you connect the dots between how the fluid starts and what happens to it later.
Right.
Like, you can predict the whole motion just from the initial setup.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. Now, let's go on to talk about what happens when viscosity, like how resistant the fluid is to flow, when that gets really, really low, almost zero. They call it vanishing viscosity or large Reynolds number. And then there's this whole thing about using shapes, like a parabola and a curve. It sounds more like art class than a physics paper.
It's actually both. It's this beautiful link between the abstract math and a visual way to understand the flow. When viscosity practically disappears, the equations simplify, and you can actually use this geometric trick. Imagine a parabola, perfect U shape, they call it S, and then you have this other curve representing the initial velocity of the fluid, how it's moving at the start.
Okay, I can picture that, a smooth curve and a parabola. So what happens then? They interact somehow.
Yeah, the parabola, it kind of glides along the curve, but they never actually cross, just touch at one point, which they label M. And that point, that's the key. It tells you the exact velocity of the fluid, UX, T, at a specific spot in time. Equation 1.9 lays it all out. Pretty neat, right?
That's actually way easier to understand than I thought it would be. But what if, hold on, what if the parabola touches the curve at two places instead of one? The text mentions these double contact points. That sounds like trouble.
Yeah, that's where things get wild. Two points of contact, that means there can be two different velocities at the same place. Doesn't really make sense physically, right? So as the viscosity gets closer and closer to zero in these cases, you get these super steep drops in velocity, like cliffs, practically vertical, and those are, you guessed it, shockwaves.
Shockwaves. Wow, that sounds intense, like something out of an action movie.
Totally. And they don't just appear randomly. They eventually form this pattern, a sawtooth profile, they call it. Imagine the teeth of a saw, sharp points going up and down.
Gotcha. So the velocity goes up gradually, then bam, a sudden drop, then up again, and another drop, like a sawtooth.
Exactly. But the crazy part is the order of these ups and downs, how long each section is, it seems totally random.
Wait, random. So even if you know how the fluid starts, you can't predict exactly what the sawtooth will look like. Nope. That's where statistics come in. You can't find one single perfect solution anymore. You got to think in terms of averages, probabilities. How often do these shocks happen? How big are they? That's the kind of question you have to ask.
So it's like trying to predict the weather. You can get a general idea, but you can't say exactly what the temperature will be at a certain time.
Perfect analogy. Now, that takes us to the next big idea, the statistical approach. They start looking at not just one initial setup, but a whole bunch of them, an ensemble, they call it.
Yeah.
Why do you think they do that?
Well, if you're dealing with randomness, you need to look at a lot of different possibilities,
yeah.
Right? Like flipping a coin once doesn't tell you much. You need to flip it a bunch of times to see the pattern. Exactly. It's about understanding the big picture, the overall behavior, not just one specific instance. And in real life, turbulence is never just one thing. It's always a mix of different conditions, fluctuations, all that. So they create this ensemble, this collection of possible starting points, and then they analyze the statistics of all the solutions they get. What are the typical patterns? What kind of variations are most common? That kind of thing.
And they have specific rules for this ensemble, right? Like, the average initial velocity has to be zero, and then there's something about invariance under shifts, and this parameter J, what's all that about?
Those are the ground rules, basically. Zero average velocity just means they're focusing on the turbulent fluctuations themselves, not some overall flow in one direction. The invariance under shifts, that's a fancy way of saying things, are statistically the same wherever you look. Imagine a patch of turbulent water, it's kind of swirling randomly everywhere, no particular direction more likely than others.
Okay, I think I'm following so far.
And then there are other more technical rules about how things behave when you flip signs or move coordinates around, and these lead to this important parameter, J.
So what is J? What does it actually tell us about the turbulence?
It's like a fingerprint of the initial state of the turbulence. It combines information about how strong the initial velocity fluctuations are, how big they are, and how spread out they are in space. It captures the essence of that initial randomness in a single number.
That's pretty neat. And then they bring back that function SX, the one for the geometric picture. How does that fit into this statistical view?
Good catch. That SX, remember, it's the integral of the initial velocity, which basically means adding up all the little velocity bits along the way. And it corresponds directly to that estic curve from before. Now, statistically, when you look at really large distances, SX becomes predictable. It follows a bell curve, a Gaussian distribution, and the shape of that bell curve depends only on J.
So no matter how complex the initial velocity is, the long-term behavior boils down to this one parameter, J.
Exactly. It's like a hidden order emerging from the chaos. Pretty cool, huh?
Definitely. And that brings us back to the sawtooth profile, the one that forms over time. The solution, UX, T, it becomes like a series of those parabolic arcs, right? The ones gliding over the curve.
You got it. And each of these arcs, they can be described by two numbers. How long it is, called K, and how much the height changes from one end to the other, called ache. And that height difference, ache, that's what determines the strength of the shop, how big the drop is in the sawtooth pattern.
So knowing the shape and size of these arcs tells you a lot about the shocks.
Absolutely. And the big question then becomes, can we figure out the probability of finding an arc with a certain length and height difference? That's where the distribution function, P, comes in.
You know, PE gives you the likelihood of seeing a particular kind of arc. Got it. What else is there?
Well, they briefly mention generalizations of this geometric method in Chapter 2. Basically, they're exploring if this cool parabola trip can be applied to other, slightly more complicated, non-linear equations. It's like seeing if the same key can open different but similar locks.
Makes sense. Now, Chapter 4 seems to shift gears completely. They start talking about a linear diffusion equation, but with this parabolic boundary. Why the sudden change? And why a parabola specifically?
It might seem like a detour, but it's actually crucial for understanding the deeper statistical behavior of the original nonlinear equation. That parabolic boundary, it comes directly from the way the problem scales, how it behaves at different sizes and times. It's not just a random shape. It's a key element that pops up naturally in the math, and it helps simplify things a lot.
I see. And then they introduce these Green's functions, GO, ZO. What are those all about?
These are like special solutions, building blocks for solving this type of equation with a boundary. Is the most basic one. Imagine a point source of something spreading out, like heat or a drop of dye in water, is a modified version that takes into account that parabolic boundary, making sure the solution is zero on that boundary. And then A and A, they are built from using calculus tricks, like derivatives and integrals. And they're even more specialized to satisfy specific conditions related to the boundary.
So it's like taking a basic solution and tailoring it to fit the specific shape of the problem.
Exactly. Now, there's also this idea of a similarity transformation that comes up. That's when certain combinations of variables like X, Y, J, and T stay the same, even when you change the scales. It's like zooming in or out on a fractal, the pattern stays the same.
Interesting. And what does that tell us about the fluid dynamics?
It implies a kind of self-similarity. Meaning, the underlying physics behaves the same way at different scales. You can then define new variables, combinations of the old ones, that capture the essence of the problem. These are called dimensionless variables because they don't have units like meters or seconds, and they often make the math much simpler. You can see hints of this in section 12.
Okay, getting a bit deep into the weeds here, but I think I'm following. They also mention an integro-differential equation for ZZ. That sounds pretty intimidating.
It is a bit more advanced. It's an equation that mixes both integrals and derivatives of this function, and it pops up when you try to solve the problem near that parabolic boundary. The solution of this equation, which involves those z functions we mentioned earlier, helps us figure out the probability distribution of certain characteristics of the shock waves.
So we're back to the shocks, the sawtooth pattern.
Exactly. And when they apply all this to the specific parabola defined by y x over 2t, what they get is a concrete formula for the probability p x plus ox x. It's given in equation 23.1, and it tells us the likelihood of finding a certain velocity difference between two points separated by a distance x at a particular time.
So it's about how the velocities are statistically connected at different points in space.
You got it. And then there's this normalization condition, which basically ensures that all the probabilities add up to one, meaning that something has to happen. It helps determine any missing numerical factors in our calculations.
That makes sense. Okay, on to chapter V. Here they start talking about expressing those Green's functions, A, E, and F, using exponentials and something called Bessel functions. More math tools, I guess.
You got it. This is where the rubber meets the road, where we start getting actual usable solutions. To solve the equation for a related function, qxv, which is connected to our Green's function, they use a clever trick with a new variable v. This leads to a fundamental solution called qov, which can be written as an infinite series and, importantly, in terms of Bessel functions.
Bessel functions. I've heard of those, but I don't really remember what they are.
They're a family of special functions that show up all the time in physics and engineering, especially when you have problems with circular or cylindrical symmetry. In this case, they pop up because of the way the problem is transformed mathematically. The properties of Bessel functions, particularly how they behave for very large positive and negative values, give us crucial information about the behavior of our solution QOV. And the fact that QOV has an infinite number of zeros, labeled n, is also really important for building the complete solution.
Okay, so we have Q barrel V, and it has these zeros, a pen V. How do those help us find the other functions, QMV, and ultimately A, E, and F?
The QMV functions are like modified versions of QOV, with the modification determined by those zeros N. Then E, E, and F are constructed as infinite series involving QMV and NN. For example, equation 32.5 shows how E is written as a series.
Infinite series always make me a bit nervous. Do we know if they actually converge to a meaningful answer?
That's a great question, and yes, the researchers address it. Because of the properties of those QMV functions and how those zeros and behave, these series do converge under certain conditions. That means we get a well-defined answer, not something that blows up to infinity.
That's good to hear. It seems like we're getting to the really nitty-gritty of the math here. Chapter 7 then talks about the average properties of a single shock wave. Any key takeaways there?
Chapter 7 brings us back to more concrete results. They use something called a p-integral to calculate average values. One of the main findings is that the average length of a parabolic arc, denoted as A, grows over time. Specifically, it goes as time to the power of 23, and it also depends on J, that parameter describing the initial turbulence. This result is given by equation 43.7.
Time to the 23 tower. Interesting. What does that tell us about how the turbulence changes?
It suggests that, on average, the typical distance between those shock waves, which they call the wavelength, gets larger over time. The smaller eddies merge together, so to speak, to form larger structures, and they also find that the average wavelength is the same as the average length of an arc.
Okay. What about the strength of the shocks, the actual velocities? How do those change?
Good question. Since velocity is related to distance divided by time, if the length scale grows with time, that means the average velocity in the shocks will actually decrease over time. It goes as time to the power of Mach 13. And consequently, the average kinetic energy in the turbulence will also decrease, going as time to the negative 23 power. The rate of energy dissipation also decreases over time, but even faster, going as time to the negative 53 power.
So on average, the turbulence kind of mellows out over time, the shocks become weaker.
Exactly. Now the last part, chapter 8, it gets even more complicated. They start looking at pairs of consecutive shocks and how they're related statistically. Then they briefly touch upon these correlation functions.
It sounds heavy.
Yeah, it gets pretty dense. They introduce this weighting function for the wavelengths. And while the average wavelength is the same as the average arc length, the actual probability of finding different specific wavelengths, it's not the same as the probability for individual arcs.
So the average is the same, but the spread of values around that average can be different. Interesting.
Right. And then when they try to calculate these correlation functions like U on U2 or U on R2, which tell you how the velocity at one point is related to the velocity at another point, the formulas get really messy. They introduce these W functions, W0y, W1, 1, 2pi, W3i, which are defined as integrals of ii and other averages. It's a way to handle the complexity. And they have to consider the distance between the two points, z, and how many of those vertical shock segments fall between them.
It sounds like a real challenge to figure out these higher order statistical relationships in turbulent flow.
It absolutely is. It comes down to the non-linear nature of the problem, how everything interacts in a complicated way, and how the turbulence keeps evolving.
So let's take a step back and try to summarize. What are the biggest takeaways from this deep dive into nonlinear fluid dynamics?
We saw how the Hof-Cole transformation, that clever mathematical trick, can be used to solve certain non-linear equations by making them linear, and how this leads to this elegant geometric picture with the gliding parabola. Then we explored how vanishing viscosity leads to those shock waves, those sudden drops in velocity, and the formation of that characteristic sawtooth pattern.
And then the statistical approach becomes crucial because of the inherent randomness of turbulent flow. We have to think in terms of ensembles of initial conditions, not just a single one.
Exactly. And that parameter J, it captures the essence of the initial turbulence. And it plays a key role in determining the statistical properties of the flow. We also talked about those probability distributions for the lengths and heights of the parabolic arcs, which are essential for understanding the statistics of the shocks.
Right. And we even ventured into the realm of a linear diffusion equation with a parabolic boundary, which turned out to be important for the deeper analysis. And then those special functions, the exponentials and Bessel functions, they came in handy for finding actual solutions. And finally, we got a glimpse into those higher order statistical relationships, the correlation functions, which are a real challenge to compute.
And through all this, we have to remember that the goal is to understand turbulent flow, something that's everywhere in nature and engineering, from the air we breathe to the water we drink to the flow of blood in our veins.
It really is amazing how these seemingly simple equations can lead to such complex and fascinating behavior.
Indeed. And this brings us to a final thought for our listeners. Could these mathematical techniques developed to understand fluid turbulence be applied to other complex systems? Could they help us understand things like the stock market, climate change, or even the brain? It's a question worth pondering.
Absolutely. And if you're feeling really adventurous, dive into those original papers and explore further. There's a whole universe of knowledge out there waiting to be discovered. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thank you for having me.
And until next time, keep exploring.
Keep learning.
And keep diving deep
into the unknown.